In this lecture, I want to explore the work of two key theorists who wrote in different decades and in different countries, but who shared similar concerns with the role that women play in society. This lecture is on the short extract from Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own and the two extracts from Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex. Bear in mind, as you read these extracts, that Woolf was writing in 1929 and de Beauvoir was writing in the 1940s. And bear in mind that Carter was born in 1940. So her formative years, which would be the 50s and 60s, when she would have been thinking about her life as a woman, were much closer to de Beauvoir and Woolf than they are to us. So these critics can be read as commentators on the state of society in the early part of the 20th century. Oh, that's why everybody's in that good mood. Okay. Yeah. Although lots of social changes occurred between the 1920 and 1967, the greatest change to come to women's lives would happen in 1968. So there's a great social change that occurred between the 1920s and 1967 when Magic Toy Shop was written. But actually, the greatest change to happen to women's lives would not occur until 1968. And this novel is situated just at that particular moment, before 1968. It's just before the women's movement really took off in Britain. And I'm going to talk about post-1968 in next week's lecture. So let's see what these critics are saying. I'm sure that you found the Woolf extract fairly easy to read and to understand. So I won't go into detail summarizing what she's saying. Instead, I'm going to offer a critique of what we've read. And I would also like to relate both Woolf and de Beauvoir's theories to Magic Toy Shop. So I'm going to talk about Woolf a little bit, but then try and read the novel in terms of Woolf's theory. And I'm going to do the same for de Beauvoir. At the beginning of the chapter from A Room of One's Own that we've read, Woolf's narrator makes a value judgment based on an assumption. She decides that, okay, one moment, I'm going to do something about this. Okay, this should be all right now, I hope. At the beginning, then, of the chapter that we read, Woolf's narrator makes a value judgment based on an assumption. She decides that in order to find answers to her questions about the different positions that men and women occupy in society and culture, she needs to consult the books of the British Museum. And here I'll just add in parentheses that until 1997, the British Library was in the British Museum. So that's why she's going to the British Museum to consult books in the library. They moved it out of the British Museum in 1997. So she's going to the British Museum to consult the British Library. Of course, she soon finds out that this assumption, that this is where truth about women lies, was rather naive and somewhat pointless. Her expectation of finding what she calls truth, unadulterated truth, in the British Museum is soon challenged. And as readers, we're left asking a key question. What is it that this narrator is actually looking for? She poses questions. She says she wants to find out, why did men, you know, at the colleges drink wine and women water? Why was one sex so prosperous and the other so poor? What effect had poverty on fiction? And what conditions are necessary for the creation of works of art? Well, there's a fundamental problem with these questions. The problem resides in this need to uncover universal truth, transnational, transhistorical truth about women. Now, the narrator's initial questions seem to imply that she's searching for answers to why women are not offered the same privileges and opportunities as men. But these questions seem to lump all women in one category and all men in another. Now, the literature she uncovers does not answer her questions. Indeed, the entries she cites are indicative of the specificities of women's experiences. Look at a sample of the kind of entries she finds under the rubric Women and Poverty: conditions in the Middle Ages of women, habits in the Fiji Islands of women, women as weaker in moral sense than men, Shakespeare's opinion of women, etc. What she finds in the books of the is indicative of the complexities of her questions. Wolf writes that the narrator's questions of why are women poor became 50 questions, until the 50 questions leapt frantically into midstream and were carried away. Now, Wolf does not hope to uncover universal truths about women. Her project is to show that the status of women is context-bound and is historically relative. Therefore, it's important to dissociate author from fictional persona when you read this book. I say this because it's important to see how Wolf uses this persona of Mary Beaton. I mean, she calls her different names throughout A Room of One's Own because she says it's not important who this person is. It's a fictional persona. It's important to see how Wolf uses this persona to distance her argument from her emotion. Because this essay, which begins with a quest to find truth, ends up being an investigation into anger. The fictionalization of this character is one of Wolf's strategies for removing the argument from her own personal feelings towards women and poverty. Note what she says about angry male authors. She says, when I read what he wrote, this male author, about women, I thought not of what he was saying, but of himself. When an author argues dispassionately, he thinks only of the argument, and the reader cannot help thinking of the argument too. Cannot but help thinking. Here we see her advocating an objective approach, a stance from whence she can examine the relationship between the sexes without prejudice. She recognizes that life for both sexes is arduous, difficult, a perpetual struggle. More than anything, it calls for confidence in oneself. And actually, this is the key point that she makes. Wolf is contextualizing her reading of the sexes. Life is difficult for both men and women, and we need self-confidence to be able to surmount difficulties. That's all very well, except that, according to Wolf, men, over time, have gained their self-confidence by subordinating women. Self-confidence, the necessary attribute for survival, for social success, has been a masculine characteristic. And it is achieved when men can see their grandeur reflected through a smaller, less significant woman. And this is where Wolf uses mirror imagery. The mirror imagery is effective here. She argues that women have been the mirrors in which men look to confirm their superiority. Mirrors are essential, she says, to heroic action as well as to violence. So what Wolf conveys to us then is not so much an angry, resentful refutation, but more of a stand, against this cultural form of subordination. She likens the dominant-subordinate relationship of men to women to fascist regimes. You know, she talks about Mussolini, and to dictatorships. She cites Napoleon. She says that women are necessary for men's heroic and violent actions, and she provocatively argues that if a woman begins to tell the truth, the figure in the looking glass shrinks. His fitness for life is diminished. How is he to go on giving judgment, dressing up, and speechifying at banquets unless he can see himself at breakfast and at dinner at least twice the size he really is? And at this point, I want to pause and think of Carter's Magic Toy Shop. Last week, if you remember, I spoke specifically about the characterization of Melanie in the novel and kind of traced her growth through the text. This week, I'm particularly interested in Uncle Philip. And I want to think about these terms that Wolf has presented us with: poverty, anger, and self-confidence. With Uncle Philip, we've got a patriarch, a man with seemingly no redeeming features, an abuser, a bully, a flat character. Uncle Philip does not really change over the course of the novel. He rarely speaks. We don't know his story. We don't know his motives. And we witness his cruelty and manipulation of others, but we don't get to know him. I suggest that one possible reading of Uncle Philip's character is that he represents an archetype. Do you know this term, archetype? Great, some of you are nodding, that's great. Okay. Here are some definitions of archetype. You know I'm going to post this PowerPoint presentation online. Please don't feel obliged to write everything on it. Okay. An archetype is a universally recognizable element that recurs across all literature and life. The psychologist Carl Jung called these elements a kind of collective unconscious, things that we all know about, but we don't have to talk about them because they're in the back of our mind. It's a collective unconscious of the human race, prototypes rather than something gained from experience. And archetypes are universal in human beings. They result in a deep emotional response for readers. And if you look into archetypes, it's fascinating. It's a controversial term, but it's fascinating. Carl Jung argues that there are archetypal characters in literature, like the archetypal villain, the archetypal helpless maiden. There's archetypal settings for stories, etc. Okay, well, if Uncle Philip is the archetypal villain, he's also the archetypal patriarch. I'm suggesting that Carter's depiction of Uncle Philip is drawn from folklore. It depends. It relies on the readers, and that's S apostrophe, lots of readers, all the readers' collective unconscious. Carter is counting on us to get what Uncle Philip represents. She depicts him through his house, his work, and the fear he instills in others. Last week, I spoke about the Gothic setting of Uncle Philip's house. His character is drawn in the spirit of the archetypal Gothic villain. So in a way, Carter is assuming that she doesn't need to tell his story. Instead, the story is told about those who are affected by him, those characters whose lives depend on him, on his. Aunt Margaret, his wife, is a silent woman. She lost her voice on her wedding night. She lost her voice because of him, and he maintains his control over her through violence and financial dependence. She basically lives in poverty. Wolf tells us that the looking glass vision is of supreme importance because it charges the vitality for the man. It stimulates the nervous system. Take it away, and man may die. In Uncle Philip's household, Aunt Margaret is emaciated. Her shrunken figure is in stark contrast to his obese and bloated figure. If he looks to her physique for confirmation that he is superior, then indeed he sees himself twice her size, twice as grand as her. Aunt Margaret is feeble, gentle, and caring to the point of self-sacrifice. Uncle Philip is, of course, the other extreme. He is monstrously powerful, oppressive, violent, almost inhuman. He operates under the spell of that illusion, as Wolf calls it, that he is the superior being in the household, and that's what gives him self-confidence. In the world that Carter depicts, Wolf's observations about gender politics are well illustrated. So as long as the wife is silent, obedient, and financially dependent, he can be loud, he can be strong, oppressive, and controlling. In Carter's novel, anger and fear are the controlling emotions. Uncle Philip's anger is never really explained, except in one scene when he expresses his sense of indignation at Melanie's father, whom he considered unmanly, lacking in masculine traits. Remember the scene when Uncle Philip is doing the dress rehearsal for the Leda and the Swan play. Do you remember that scene? He tells her to come down and practice. This is the exchange that happens between him and Melanie. "I never could abide your father. He thought himself too good for the flowers by a long chalk," he did. "A writer," he called himself. "Soft bastard, he never got his hands dirty." "But he was awfully clever," protested Melanie. "Not so clever, he thought to put a bit by to take care of you lot when he'd gone. And so I've got his precious kids all for my very own, haven't I? To make into little flowers." Carter must have laughed out loud when she wrote that sentence. That's fantastic. "To little flowers." In this exchange with Melanie, Uncle Philip articulates his definition of masculine behavior by reading himself in opposition to Melanie's father. Unlike Melanie's father, who was an intellectual, not working with his hands, and who did not save money, Uncle Philip, the worker, the breadwinner, is the successful male who gets to keep the progeny and mold them into his own. By referring to Melanie's father in this way, Uncle Philip emasculates him, really. The father then occupies a feminine position. He is the looking glass, and Uncle Philip sees himself reflected in him twice as big. So you see, the position of the feminine is not necessarily a gendered position. It's not necessarily occupied by a female. In Carter's novel, the dominant version of masculinity is one where the man oppresses, damages, and controls. It's a violent and unsympathetic portrayal, which is archetypal. But, and more importantly, which is clearly depicted as archaic. I'm going to repeat the sentence. The dominant version of masculinity in Carter's novel is violent, is one that of violence and lack of sympathy, of course, but it is clearly depicted as archaic. And that's the crucial point. Be careful when you read this novel not to assume that Carter, like the narrator in Wolf's text, is categorizing all men as patriarchal villains. Uncle Philip is carefully placed in the narrative within an outdated, derelict setting. Uncle Philip's shop is antiquated, his house is in ruins, his opinions are out of touch with the London that Melanie can see from her window. Uncle Philip's world is incompatible with the changing landscape of London. Do you remember the scene where a wealthy American customer comes and buys lots of toys, and then she tries to pay by check? And Melanie says to her, oh, I'm sorry, we don't accept checks here, we only accept cash. And the American woman says, gee, because that's what Americans say, gee, I think it's charming. It suits your old-fashioned kind of shop, kind of Dickensian. Sorry if there's Americans in the room. Okay. This reaction, that was all right, wasn't it?
I thought that was good.
Thank you. This reaction from the American lady is important. Carter clearly locates the character of Uncle Philip in a distant setting. He is anachronistic and must be destroyed. So in order to liberate Aunt Margaret and the rest of the family, Carter knows that this home, this house, must burn. By the way, I hope you recognized this strategy that Carter uses, the burning of the patriarch's home, which is a typical trope of feminist writing. If you've read Jane Eyre, you know that at the end, we all cheer when Rochester's house burned to the ground. So that's the sort of thing she's trying to do, just burn it off. So Carter burns the house down. Aunt Margaret can have money as a result and be independent. Like Wolfe's narrator, Aunt Margaret can be free if she has the freedom to think of things in themselves. That's a beautiful sentence in Wolfe's text. The freedom to think of things in themselves. The narrator in Wolfe's text says, I want to know if when I look at a building and find it architecturally attractive, I want to know if this is really my opinion or whether I think so because I've been told to think so. And that's a really well articulated point about how we're being taught to read art, to think about architecture, but also to decide on the value, the relative value of things around us. So what I'm saying is that Aunt Margaret, once the patriarch is gone, she is then free to think of things for themselves, to have her own opinions. And of course, she can have the financial independence to be able to survive without needing him. The toy shop was the space of patriarchy. It was the locus of oppression and represented the antithesis to the room of one's own. Its burning signifies a release from this patriarchal form of oppression. Of course, what is unclear in Carter's novel is what happens next. And this is, I think, my main critique of the novel. It's not necessarily a criticism, but this is a point I wish to make. Carter's novel identifies the source of oppression and fleshes out its components. The burning of the house at the end leaves an enduring image in the reader's mind, but actually the novel has not offered a space for the emancipated, if you like, characters. What will happen to the Red family? What will happen to Melanie? The novel doesn't actually give us any hints as to what spaces they can then occupy. Wolfe writes that anything can happen when womanhood has ceased to be a protected occupation. And I can see why Carter would have agreed with this, but what I can't see in this novel is an attempt to create some kind of feminine space. Of course, this is an early Carter text, and in her later novels, that's precisely what she tries to do. So it's at this point that I want to move on to de Beauvoir, because I think that de Beauvoir attempts to answer some of the concerns I have raised about Carter and Wolfe. And just to say that there's no way that I expect you to become absolute experts on existentialism and all the philosophical points that she tries to summarize in these two extracts. What we want to tease out of the de Beauvoir extract is just the necessary tools that we need to allow us to read the texts on this course. Now, the opening lines of de Beauvoir's essay on myth and reality identify her project as one that aims to reconcile myths about femininity with the reality of women's lives. Those are her two key terms, the myth about women's lives and the reality about women's lives are different, and she's trying to reconcile the two. De Beauvoir suggests that myths about femininity fix the roles that women can play, and therefore renders their existence static, renders women's lives static, unchanging. So to think that woman exists as the opposite of man makes woman unchangeable and static. This is her idea of the eternal feminine. So I'm just going to explain this concept further. The eternal feminine, or what she calls that vague and basic essence, femininity. Look at her words, vague, unclear, basic essence, femininity, is a myth, she says. The sets of attributes that society dictates that all women must follow, the set of attributes that society tells us all women are born with, are mythical attributes. The myth of the eternal feminine takes many forms. For example, thinking about the myth of the sanctity of the mother, the purity of the virgin. These myths serve to deny women's individuality and trap them inside unrealizable roles. Look at what she says. Thus, as against the dispersed, contingent, and multiple existences of actual women, mythical thought opposes the eternal feminine, unique and changeless. The mythical is changeless, it's fixed. It doesn't adapt itself to the lives of actual women who have multiple existences. Actual women exist in multiple roles, but the myths of the eternal feminine constrain them. And de Beauvoir warns that the myths of the eternal feminine are so powerful that if a woman's behavior contradicts or challenges them, then we are told not that femininity is a false entity, but that the women concerned are not feminine. So in the first part of her essay, she sets out to debunk the myth of the eternal feminine, a myth based on an essentialist reading of women which has no equivalent for men. There is no eternal masculine, she points out, as she posits that there is no essence to gender identity. You're not born with a particular set of attributes. There is only experience. And this is where, this is not in this extract, her famous dictum, but it is relevant. She says, on ne n'est pas femme, on le devient. She says, one is not born woman, one becomes it. And of course, this is the statement that's been mistranslated for centuries. This is the correct translation. It's not one becomes one, because that doesn't make sense. One becomes it. One becomes that woman. Okay. So you see, it's not essence, it's experience that turns a person into a woman. And so de Beauvoir explains that if man fails to discover that secret essence of femininity, it is simply because it does not exist. This debunking of the essentialist myth attached to gender identity becomes even more relevant when we think about Western myths, which have dictated gender roles over the centuries. And this is a concern that is manifest in Carter's writing. In The Magic Toy Shop, and certainly in subsequent novels and short stories, Carter examines the myths that society perpetuates, that society imposes on women. Last week, I discussed this statement by Carter. This is about her saying what happened in 1968, why 1968 was so important. She said, we were truly asking ourselves questions about the nature of reality. I can date to that time and to that sense of heightened awareness of the society around me in the summer of 1968, my own questioning of the nature of my reality as a woman. How that social fiction of my femininity was created by means outside my control and palmed off on me as the real thing. Can you see the Beauvoir in the background? The same concerns about myth and reality. Who is telling me who I am? This investigation of the social fictions that regulate our lives, what Blake called the mind-forged manacles, is what I've concerned myself with consciously since that time. In this quote, Carter expresses concerns similar to Beauvoir's, to de Beauvoir's. She stresses the importance of separating reality from myth because myths are artificial constructs that regulate lives. In the magic toy shop, the myth of Leda and the swan is used as a narrative device, a motif to represent a particular relationship between Uncle Philip and Melanie. He is the puppet maker and the puppeteer. She is the puppet who has to perform a role prescribed to her by myth. Can you see what's going on in this? I just found it randomly on Google Images. This is a swan doing something to a woman hanging. They're both suspended in midair, and there's some kind of puppet person that you don't see manipulating them. It's quite weird, isn't it? Yes, I think Carter would have approved. In this role of puppet, Melanie cannot improvise. She cannot react. She cannot revise her character. She is beautiful, passive puppet who must submit to the will of the puppeteer. In the novel, no one can save Melanie from the role prescribed to her by Uncle Philip, who goes as far as to suggest that Finn lay with Melanie on the same night as the performance would take place, so the myth would be fulfilled. Have you looked up the myth? So on the night that Zeus turned himself into a beautiful swan and raped Leda, on that same night, her husband had lain with her. Therefore, when she gives, when she lays three eggs, or whichever version you're reading, the eggs that she lays have two different fathers. And so one is a god, one is her actual husband, well, who was also a mythical character. But in the novel, Uncle Philip wants the swan to come and attack Melanie, but he also suggests that Finn should also, on that same night, have his way with her, because he's so absorbed in that myth. He so wants to manipulate that myth. So the question here is, how could Carter's use of myth be interpreted here? Well, de Beauvoir explains that enforcing myth is a way of self-justification for patriarchy. This is very similar to Wolf's idea about self-confidence. She says, have I got it? Yeah. Through the myths, this society imposed its laws and customs upon individuals in a picturesque, effective manner. Through such intermediaries as religions, traditions, language, tales, songs, movies, the myths penetrate even into such existences as are most harshly enslaved into material realities. Carter's use of the myth of Leda and the swan is an example of intertextuality. She refers to the myth in order to debunk it, to show that Uncle Philip is attempting to indoctrinate Melanie by forcing her into a performance of the role of the submissive puppet. This performance is there to force Melanie into submission, into adopting what de Beauvoir calls the transcendent idea of femininity, which is opposed to the reality of femininity. So de Beauvoir and Carter agree that woman's condition has remained the same through superficial changes, and its condition, and it is this condition that determines what is called the character of woman. She revels in imminence. She is false. She is contrary. But what should we take away from all this? I'm going to wrap up now what I've been presenting to you. What do we take away from this? Wolf, De Beauvoir, and Carter agree that women's lives are governed by a paradox of their situation. They belong to one and the same time. They belong at one and the same time to the male world and to a sphere in which that world is challenged. So women are stuck between two worlds, and that's the paradox of their existence. They're shut up in their world, surrounded by the other. They can settle down nowhere in peace. Do you get this? That they are torn. They are torn. De Beauvoir sees them torn between myths of femininity and the actuality of their lives. Wolf sees them stuck between old and new, tradition and new. And Carter doesn't know what to do with the emancipated characters at the end, because she doesn't yet see a space for them. And that's the paradox that they present. So in 1967, this is precisely the situation that Carter depicts, a situation where women exist in a liminal space, where the male world is all-powerful, but where there is room for challenge. Now, how does the challenge happen? What characteristics will this challenge take? This is specifically what I'm going to talk about next week with Sixu and Irigaray. Okay? Good? Wait.